the Q, the O, and the Dub. Welcome to Junior, the CHL podcast with Jeff Merrick and Sam Cosentino. From now until the MasterCard Memorial Cup, this is the destination for news, opinion, and prospects. No one does the CHL like this.
Well, here we are once again after a one-week hiatus. Apologies for last week's technical issues, but we have returned, Sam Cosentino, with another edition of your favorite CHL podcast. It is, of course, Junior, and this week, Sammy, we feature Double DeBrusque. We're going to bring it to you last week. We have Louis DeBrusque, former London Knight, and we have current Swift, current Bronco, and on his way to the NHL, the CHL-NHL Top Prospect game brought to you by BMO, his son Jake, who is in now at number 24 on the midterm rankings for Central Scouting. Oh, we should have mentioned this right off the top too, Sam. Don Cherry, former Barry Flyer, Windsor Spitfire.
Oh, yeah.
On the program here too. Now, yeah. We see Don at this game every year. Always fun, Team Cherry versus Team Moore. But he's out watching minor midget hockey with his son, Tim, 3-4 days a week. This guy, he doesn't fake it. He's out there watching kids.
Yeah, it's pretty cool that, you know, and we talked to him a little bit about this, but the fact that you get to see kids at 14 if you're watching Bantam games, and then up through minor midget at 15, and then the ability to watch them grow into year one in the respective league that they're in, and then you get to see the kid perform in the BMO CHL NHL Top Prospects game, and it's kind of a cool progression to see how a guy grows. I mean, Jake DeBrusque is a perfect example. I think it was 5'2 in his Bantam draft year, and obviously he's grown to greater heights now at almost 6 feet tall. So it's cool to watch the guys grow physically. It's cool to watch how they develop hockey wise and see how they mature. So yeah, it's a really neat thing.
You know, you mentioned DeBrusque and, of course, Father Louis as well, who works with us on Sportsnet. It's almost as if, you know, this year's draft has another Domi flavor to it, in that there's the dad who was a tough guy in the NHL and the son who's a skilled player in his junior league, in his junior career. Jake DeBrusque and Louis DeBrusque. How much in your estimation? Because I think I'm one of those guys, Sam, that thinks it really means a lot when you have or had a parent or an uncle that went through it. Like if dad went through it or your uncle went through it. If you're a second-generation guy and you grew up around it and you're just acclimatized to that hockey lifestyle, I really believe it gives a kid a leg up than if your parent never played hockey or never made it that far. Do you agree or disagree?
Oh, yeah, there's no question. I think Jansen Harkins is the same type of guy. They seem to be the guys with greater hockey sense. And you know what, Jeff? Something that I really like to make clear is, you know, you look at a Domi or a DeBrusque, and we look at them sometimes as fans and you say, yeah, they weren't very good hockey players. But if you were to step out on the ice with those guys right now, they would absolutely dazzle you. And I know you know this, but to some of the listeners, they would dazzle you with their ability to handle the puck and skate. I mean, it's completely at a different level. And so in terms of their NHL peers, they might have not have been great goal scorers and they might not have been the best offensive guys. But in terms of the general 100%. Fandom. These guys were marvelous, marvelous players. And so kids that are second-generation guys often pick up on that. Why? Yeah, they're around the game and they get exposed to it and they get coach talk and whatever else. But if they're playing with their dad in the front yard, you know, ball hockey, they're out in the pond with their dad, or they're out on the ice with their dad, you know, coaching, you pick up so much stuff in terms of your ability, like your stick skills and your skating and those sorts of things that even the players that we would deem lesser players in the National Hockey League still have unbelievable skill. Like if you went out and played with Ty Domi right now or Louis DeBrusque right now, it would blow you away just how good they are.
Well, and specifically,
so you can't forget about that.
When you look at Max Domi's skating, that comes right from dad. I mean, the one thing you can say about Ty, and to your point, you know, at the peer group at the NHL, he's not going to be lighting it up as an offensive force. But the one thing about Ty you could never deny was that this guy could flat out skate, and that's where Max gets it. And you know, and hockey's that sport too. So I've always maintained this: hockey's one of the sports where you have to be so good just to be thought of as someone that doesn't belong on the ice, that shouldn't be there. You know, the bottom 20, 30 guys in the NHL that are just barely hanging on to a spot. You have to be so good just to be in a position to be a player that people criticize night in and night out.
Oh, yeah, your talent, I mean, you're one of a, you know, let's say 1,000 people in the world. you know, if you look at the NHL rosters and you extend it a little bit, you know, maybe you're one of 800 or 1,000 people in the world that are considered good enough to do that job. I mean, that's amazing. And Domi and DeBrusque were those guys for sure.
Yep, 100%. So we have the BMO CHL NHL Top Prospects game on Thursday as we tape this podcast. It is Tuesday afternoon. I'm at home in Stouffville, heading there tomorrow. You're already in St. Catharines. What have you been up to today?
Yeah, just over doing some stuff with Draft Year this morning. You know, the show that's fallen around the six guys. Of the six guys, only David Henley didn't make the cut. But Sprong, Konechny, Merkley, Bittner, and Dylan Strome are all here. So it's kind of cool that the show gets to follow them to this game. And it's a big event. It's one of the marquee events RJ and Falzi and I really love to be a part of each and every year because you can get you really hunker down and you can get in here. Like here we are on Tuesday, the game's not till Thursday. We'll go to the practices tonight. You'll get a good feel for the guys. Media availability, same thing will happen tomorrow. So you really get to know the player and not just by name and number on a jersey. And that's what probably I like most about this event. And I think, Jeff, the other element that you're starting to experience on a weekly basis in working with Don is, you know, spend time with guys like him and Killer and even Kipper and McLean, who sometimes we take for granted because we work with them, just about their knowledge and some of the stories that they have. So that's also a fun element to this thing.
Are there one or two guys that you look at and you say to yourself, they really need to have a good game because all eyes are going to be on this one, all scouts, general managers, everybody in the hockey world that's involved in prospecting essentially is going to be watching this game. And I think back to Halifax, watching Ryan Hartman play on that line with McKinnon and Drouin, and that really helped his draft stock, ends up going first round to the Chicago Blackhawks. And he sort of dovetails that into a nice transition to the program. Are there one or two guys in your mind that need to have or could really stand to use a really solid showing on Thursday's game?
Well, here's one guy, and I'm not sure if he'd be on your radar, Jeff, but I think Brandon Carlo is that guy. I mean,
Tri-City.
He did not look out of place. Yeah, he played with Zach Werenski and Noah Hanifin on the Team USA at the World Juniors, and he didn't look out of place in that group. He came back to try, and, you know, like a lot of players who play in that event, they come back to their club team and they take a bit of a down tick. But to me, he's a guy that I'm still trying to figure out exactly what he is. I think there's some scouts in that same mold, and this game might give a better indication as to what he'll be. Is he a physical guy? Is he just a puck-moving guy? Is he a guy who defends because he's, you know, he's such a big guy, a tall guy? What exactly is he? And I think this game in particular is going to help him more define that role. Is there someone that you're thinking about
I was going to say Mitch Van de Sopel because he could really stand a good showing sort of away from the Oshawa Generals, the number one team in the CHL. That's the one guy that I said, you know what, here's someone that can really distinguish themselves. You know, here's someone that you can just look at and you say, yeah, you know what, sure, he looks great. He's playing on the Oshawa Generals. But I was really looking forward to Mitch playing away from that Jenny's team, but he's not going to be available for service because he's injured. So that was going to be my guy. And
I
that
got one,
one
for you, Jeff.
Oh, what do you got?
I got one for you. How about Travis Konechny?
Hasn't had
How about Travis Konechny.
It wasn't that long ago we were talking about him being a potential top five pick.
That's right.
With the Ottawa 67s.
You're exactly right.
And it wouldn't if he with a really good showing, and he's played much better of late with a really good showing.
He has,
in the prospects game. He may reestablish himself as someone that could be knocking on that door. Well, how about a player like Daniel Sprong? With the Charlottetown Islanders.
Yeah.
Sprong was another guy who were saying, you know, bona fide, top 10, maybe even go as high as 7 in some people's rankings last year. All of a sudden, when you're talking Charlottetown, now you're talking Philip Schlappick more than you're talking about Daniel Sprong. Maybe Sprong's guy that can stand to have a good one.
Those two guys to me, I mean, I think Carlo, you know, I've mentioned him already, but Konechny and Sprong are two guys. I agree with you on Sprong, definitely, and Konechny. You're right, he's starting to play better again. But he's always going to fight the size thing. And you looked at him as a top 10 before. He's a guy I think this game's really important for him.
What about a guy like Mackenzie Blackwood? Barry Colts netminder who, when you look at him and you watch him play, I mean, the first thing that you notice is the size. Like, the first thing you see is this is a big goaltender that covers up a lot of the nets. And, you know, goaltenders now are the purview of the second round. But where do you put a player like Mackenzie Blackwood?
I think he's the best goalie available in this draft, and I think the disappointing thing from a viewing perspective is Callum Booth won't be here because I think those guys are one and two. But if you're looking at it from Blackwood's perspective individually, he's saying now the door's kind of open for me because, you know, I know the other guys aren't quite as highly rated. I know I was in competition with Booth as being the, you know, the potential top goalie picked in the draft. I'm never, and I think I've said this in the show before, I'm never a fan of taking a guy in the first round, a goaltender, because your Carey Prices and Marc-Andre Fleury just come along too few and far between for me. And as Dan, you know, alluded to, and you'll hear it a little later on, I think he said something like 70% of the guys in the NHL that are selected in the first and second rounds are there now. So you're getting better percentages with those higher picks. And I think that drops significantly with goalies. But for me, you know, I hope Blackwood's at 100% health. I know he was sick. I think his fever broke here Tuesday or Monday night. So hopefully by Thursday he's feeling back to the top of his game. He's battled the injury issue a little bit earlier this year. He's a guy who's got pretty much a good three quarters of a season under his belt from last year as a first year goalie in the league, and now he's going to have the opportunity with a good showing here that I think he's going to solidify himself as the number one goalie available.
Feel bad for Booth when you consider that he will not play the lion's share of the games for the Quebec Ramparts now and could really use a good showing going up here on pier. Zach Fucali is playing as the number one guy there, so you said to yourself, maybe this is, and we'll all see what happens with injuries and the like, and we saw what happened with Zach Fucali last year against Val-d'Or, but it looks like this may be the last big, like really big game that Callum Booth plays in if you expect Zach Fucali to run the table for the Ramparts.
Yeah, that's disappointing, and it's a big opportunity. But you know what, Jeff? A lot can be learned from being in these situations. And who knows what Fucali's going to do? I mean, if you look at last year, maybe Booth becomes an important piece again, and maybe guys are looking at Booth and saying, really learn from this experience deep in the playoffs. Learn from a guy like Fucali, so that while you are probably going to be picked more on projection than most other guys in this draft, that you can take the opportunity to learn from a, you know, a MasterCard Memorial Cup winner, a World Junior Gold medalist. You can take that opportunity and learn from Fucali, but it is difficult, and it's always a challenge when you get goalies even in their second year to play full minutes, because most of the time, because it takes so long to develop the position, your best guys are 19 and 20 years old. And so it's a real challenge for the draft, first-year draft-eligible goalies, no question.
You know, if you look at a team more, the left side is pretty heavy. Lawson Crouse and Paul Bittner, two of the biggest left wingers in the draft, are both on the same team. And as much as, you know, this is, you know, the Connor McDavid and the Jack Eichel, you know, there's another crop of guys that, you know, we look at Mitch Marner and we look at Dylan Strome, some high, you know, high offense, Nick Merkley with Kelowna Rockets. There's some high octane offense in this draft when you go top 15. There's also some beef as well. There's also some power. Lawson Crouse and Paul Bittner have to be top of that list. And if you look at Bittner for central scouting right now in at 19, Lawson Crouse all the way up to number 4. And if you look at some of the independents, I mean, ISS has Lawson Crouse at number 3 above Noah Hanifin.
Yeah, and I think the World Juniors had a lot to do with that. I think Crouse might have elevated himself over Hanifin in that role. And previous to the tournament, I don't think there's any way you would have said that. But the thing about Crouse for me, and getting to know him a little bit, he's got wonderful self-awareness, Jeff. He knows, and I know you know Paul McFarlane really well, the head coach there in Kingston. He knows what he is. That's tough for a 17, 18-year-old kid to know what they are already. Crouse knows exactly what he is. He knew going into Team Canada, he knew exactly what his role was going to be. He didn't care. He just said, all right, I'll adjust my game and play that role. Still put up 3 points, and it still played a fourth line energy role. So his self-awareness is amazing. Timo Meier is another one of those heavy guys you talk about. 6'1", 210 pounds, 212 pounds, whatever he is a guy who's really starting to play well. I think he's been aided by playing with Nikolai Ehlers. But I love when these lists come out because you get an opportunity to see where central scouting has moved guys up, down, whatever else. It's always a fun day, don't you think, when you get your stuff like from ISS and central? Yeah, it's a blast.
Well, I mean, central came out today, and I'm looking, wow, look how high they have Jacob Sporl. And right underneath that, there's Timo Meier. Both of them are ahead of Nick Merkley. And I think at the beginning of the season, if you told me that Timo Meier was going to be ahead of Nick Merkley, I said, I really can't see that happening, but there it is right now for Central Scouting. It's almost like Christmas morning, and you get like an. We all know that Connor's going to be on top. We know Jack Eichel's going to be number two. After that, in a lot of ways, it's jump ball. Look at number six. It was Zach Werenski with Central Scouting. You know, going into the season, I almost said to myself, it's tough as a freshman defenseman playing with a team like the University of Michigan. Is he going to get the minutes? Or are the London Knights going to be able to pry him away from Red Berenson and bring him into their mix? But so far, not only is he getting the minutes, but a guy like Zach Werenski is jumping over every hurdle you put in front of him. But you're right. Like, these rankings come out. It's almost like Christmas morning all over again. You see where, you know, Jake DeBrusque, we just talked about, see where he is, see where Konechny is, and how he's moved down to 26 by way of Central. But everyone's is a little bit different. And, I mean, every scout values things differently than every other scout. So there's only one report that really matters ultimately, and that's draft day in Sunrise this year. But it's a lot of fun getting there, isn't it? It's a ton of fun getting there.
Yeah, it's a blast, and it's fun for me to watch. You know, I'm lucky enough that I can get out in the road and watch these guys live and in person sometimes, you know, in practice or morning skates where it's not necessarily always that game situation. And you know, I think scouts can do that once in a while, too, and just to help evaluate. You look at body language and how they react with teammates. Are they first or last, you know, first guy out in the ice, last guy off, that sort of stuff. That stuff's always helpful. So we're, you know, in particular, you know, RJ and Falzi and I are lucky that we get to see a little bit of that that extra that sometimes scouts don't see. Mm-hmm. Big part of the reason why I love my gig so much, Jeff.
You got a sweet one. I know that that you enjoy it. You can tell every time you're on the air. We can't talk about top prospects game without mentioning, oh, yeah, Connor McDavid, who's, you know, the best player. I know, that guy, 97, plays on that Bassin guy's team, you know, 97.
Yeah,
I don't know how many coming out parties we're scheduling for Connor McDavid, but, Sammy, this one is another one. What do you expect from McDavid on Thursday?
I expect him to be himself, and that's the thing. When you look at this game in general, you talk about how scouts weight this game, where the weighting to me sits greatest is your ability to translate the game that you play with your club team and bring it to this game. You're playing with better players, you're playing against better players, and you're not going to get the, you know, especially in home ice where you get those shifts off where you can maybe play and get matched up against a third or fourth line. That's not going to happen in this game. There is really no third and fourth line. Most everyone is of equal talent. And so what's your ability? How is it that you're able to translate your game with your club team to this game in particular? And I think that's where scouts weight this thing the most. And when it comes to Connor, I don't expect his game to change one bit. I think he's going to be a guy who electrifies the crowd. I think he's going to create opportunities all over the ice. And he is going to have an impact. There's no question he'll have an impact in this game.
Every time I watch him play, whether it's live or on television on the OHL Action Pack, at least once, Sam, during a game where Connor is playing, I say to myself, how did he do that? I want to watch that again. Like every single game, Sam, there's something different that I see from Connor McDavid. Is there? I mean, everyone focuses on the speed and the creativity and the vision. What's the most important part of McDavid's game for you?
I think it's his breakaway ability, his speed. I mean, There are two elements to speed. Some players, most players possess one or the other. Very few does a player possess both. Your high-end speed that once you get going, your top-end speed, but your ability to get there, that's the other one. McDavid has both. He has the ability to escape from you out of a corner because he can accelerate so quickly, but his top-end speed seems to have that extra gear that once he goes down the wing, how many times have you seen him burn guys down the wing?
Oh, I know.
He has the ability to do both. Not many players have that. A lot of players have that good top-end speed or they have that good acceleration. McDavid has both. That's rare for a player to have.
And when he cuts across the ice, he gets faster. Like when you look at a player who moves laterally, he gets faster when he cuts, Sam.
His edging is amazing. You know who edges similarly to him is Mitch Marner. Mitch Marner. Mm-hmm. I know you've watched a lot of him
in London. Yeah,
but his ability, where he looks really light on his skates and he edges so well and can cut in a dime and that sort of thing. Yeah, Marner has a similar edging ability. But there's everything about Connor McDavid's skating that I think separates him from the crowd.
And you know what? Fans got to see this during the World Junior Hockey Championships. Considering that Connor is not, 6'4", 220 pounds, about 6'1", 195, maybe 200, his forecheck is incredibly intense. He is like a pit bull on a pork chop on the forecheck, Sam. It's remarkable. He's not a huge guy.
He knows, though, that A, he's probably smarter than everybody out there, and B, he's got such a quick stick that if he can't beat you with his smarts, he'll beat you with his stick. And he's just big enough physically where he can handle the rough and tumble. And once he fills out, I mean, he's going to be a really difficult player to play against.
He'll be scary. All right, still to come on the program, we will talk to Nicolas Corbet. He is a QMJHL alum, also an alum of the CHL-NHL Top Prospects game going back to 2001. You will hear from Don Cherry as well, and the DeBrusque family, father Louis and son Jake, part of the Top Prospects game in St. Catharines on Thursday. We'll be right back, me and Sam, after this.
Hi, I'm Nick Foligno of the Columbus Blue Jackets, and I played for the Sudbury Wolves in the OHL.
Our next guest really needs no introduction, Sam. He is not only one of the most recognizable personalities in Canadian hockey, he is one of the most recognizable personalities in Canada. He is, of course, Don Cherry, someone who has won the Memorial Cup himself. We'll talk about 53 in a second. A pleasure to welcome to the Junior Podcast, Don Cherry. Grapes, how are you today, sir?
Hey, thanks for having me on, guys.
The pleasure is all ours. And, of course, you'll be coaching against Bobby Orr in the BMO CHL-NHL Top Prospects game. When you look at the kids, Don, today, what comes to your mind right away? What's improved? How do you judge the kids these days? What do you notice about hockey where it's at right now at the junior level?
Well, since I started, the size of the guys. That's the thing that I first rate. And the speed. That's about it. But the size gets me when I shake hands. I'm around 6 foot myself. And I 16-year-old kids and 17-year-old kids, my goodness, the size, when they get their skates on, you feel like a midget.
One of the cool things for me is being able to watch kids as they grow. And I know you go to a lot of Bantam games, a lot of minor midget games. I kind of start my viewing at the minor midget. But what kind of satisfaction does it give you when you've seen a kid from Bantam move through minor midget and then all of a sudden he's in this game? What kind of satisfaction is that for you?
Well, first of all, I saw McDavid when Marlies were in the playoffs, and they had a bunch of guys hurt, and they brought up Roland McHugh, and you remember him, and of course, and McDavid, and you see him, you knew he was right off the bat, but you see other guys now that when we go out, we see them at the start of the season and watch how they skate, and they look clumsy. They're like Colts, some of the big guys, eh? And then you see them at the end of the set, and they really are skating, so in that minor midget, that's where you really notice the difference of them in the year. So it really is something. Like, I've seen them all, like Stamkos and all that, and can almost tell those guys. But you see some other guys that you start the season and you think these guys are never going to be hockey players, and in about 3 or 4 months it's dynamite. Like, we're right in the playoffs now.
You know, the first time, John, that I saw Connor McDavid was at the OHL Cup. His Marlboros ultimately lost out to Mississauga. But I remember the first time I saw him, I said to myself, he doesn't look like a minor midget hockey player. He almost looks like he's a professional, polished hockey player. There's not a lot of minor hockey in him, if that makes sense. What was the first thing that jumped out for you when you first saw Connor McDavid?
Well, the way he could handle a puck, that was that got me. Like, he'd make those little moves back and forth, and it was the way he handled a puck that got me. His skating was great and everything like that, but little things he did with the puck, and boy, could he wire a puck too. He was just a kid brought up for the playoffs that year, but, God, I mean, and he can wire a puck, and he's got that hockey sense. Now, I'm not comparing him to Gretzky or anybody that yet, but you saw that goal in junior hockey where he went to the right, and he come right back, and was like he was playing with the goaltender. It was like you do with a little wee kid, and it's the way he handles the puck, and his hockey sense gets me.
What most do you enjoy about coaching in this game in particular? I mean, obviously you get to see Bobby. I know you have such a great relationship with Killer and Bert. But where do you find the most enjoyment when you get to coach this game and see the kids?
Well, I would say having a few beers with Brian the night before, but I guess that wouldn't go over too good. And I don't think I've ever coached that game without a headache, to tell you the truth. But I think it's just talking to the kids. I'll tell you the funny story. About Duchesne, and we were ready to go out, and you know how you're waiting, they're lined up waiting to go out, so I was just standing there, and Matt says, Mr. Cherry, your coach's corner saved my grandfather's life, and I don't know if you heard this, but I'll tell it anyhow. And I said, how's that? He says, well, we have a dairy farmer, my grandfather and grandmother, and he says, the cows were out there mooing and everything in the back, and he said, my grandfather went on, and put a goat's coat on. He said, wait a minute, I'm going to watch Coach's Corner first. Well, you remember when they had that big snowstorm?
Yeah.
And that was about 80 years ago or whatever it was. And he says, while they were watching Coach's Corner, the barn collapsed and 3/4 of the cows were killed. And he said, if you hadn't been watching Coach's Corner, he would have been killed too. Huh. And one of the kids in front of me says, well, Coach's Corners are good for something.
It's good for your health. That could be a new tagline for Coach's Corner. Wow, that's a fantastic story.
Yeah, and, you know, that's what I'm saying. You like the best fun is with the kids and, you know, and talking to them like that. And when they have breakfasts and that, they're awful shy. Eh? Everybody's awful shy. And they don't say much. And the big thing is that they're quiet. They have breakfasts and they have their lunch and I guess they don't want to make too much money, you know, too much noise in front of everybody because they really don't know each other, I guess. But the silence, it really is, and they're mean it. I mean, this is not, they realize there's going to be about 200 guys there watching them and that, and they're serious. It's not really, not the fun that, I try to have it as much fun, especially this year. I'm going to try to have a little more fun and try to get them not so serious.
Oh, that would be wonderful. Hey, do you mind if we talk about your Memorial Cup experience? I've always wanted to ask you, but I've never had a chance to. I'm really looking forward to this. So it's the Barrie Flyers. It's 1953. We'll get to the Winnipeg Amphitheater here in a couple of seconds. But I heard a story once about when you guys won the Ontario Championships and you're going on to Winnipeg and you're facing off against St. Boniface, the Canadiens. Is it true that in the final game against St. Michael's that Hap Ems sent a present to the opposition coach, and when he opened the box, it was a book said "How to Coach" called "How to Coach Hockey."
That was really something. That's true, and I'll tell you, it was against St. Mike's. It was in Barrie, and it was before we played the Marlies. And Happy, he was a mean guy. I have to say, the greatest mind I ever played for, but he was a mean guy, and he owned it. He was really rich, and he just did it. I don't know why he was so mean, but we were really smoking. Billy Dineen actually played on that club. He was the captain. And he called Billy Dineen over. It was about a minute ago or 2 minutes ago, and we're smoking him. I don't think we lost the game. But anyhow, you give him a present, and all the guys thought, uh-oh, there's something going on here. And he did. That's right. Father Sear, I think it was, he took it over to him and give him and opened it up, How to Coach Hockey. And Billy Dineen charged our bench and tried to get in and get at Hap. It was
wow.
So and I'll tell you another thing he did. We were 16,005 in the Maple Leaf Gardens, and we were smoking the Marlies again and on our way to play the Citadels. And the last minute and a half, we had a power play, and we couldn't go over our blue line. We just kept passing the puck around. And the crowd was like, you know, and they'd run at us and get another penalty, and it was 5-on-3. Wouldn't let us go over the blue line, just pass the puck around. I mean, that's,
wow.
And they were going nuts. He was, and then we went into Citadels, played the Citadels right in Quebec. And back then they had no glass on the sides, if you can believe it.
Mm-hmm.
And one of our players got pulled, Skippy Teal, got pulled into the crowd and had a cigarette burnt on his neck. It was something. We look around, Skippy beating the guy over the head with a stick, and it was just something. We beat them, and we lost one game, I think, in that series, and it said the only reason they lost that Barrie Flyers' head was so big. Then we went out west to Winnipeg, and we were playing longer than we took a train out, and then we were playing longer than the Stanley Cup. And we finally had two games, and then we went to Brandon, and we beat them right. St. Boniface Canadians, we beat them right in Winnipeg. And I tell you, it was about 90 degrees outside. And Brian Hextall coached the grandfather of Ronnie and Brian.
Yep. And you scored in games 4 and 5. And notably as well, you got into what was described to me as a spirited fight with Frank Holiday. What do you remember from that?
I didn't remember the guy's name, but I remember it was a pretty good fight, and it wasn't much. I like it when I win big, so I won that one big, and I did get 2 goals. I played regular. I wasn't like I was in pro. I did play regular on that team. It was called the best team.
So I guess
why? Because Hap went out and got all the best players, you know, when they were on and paid the money, I don't think we lost 2 games all year.
Amazing.
Or all in the playoffs.
Would What do you think about the evolution of the event and where it's come to, you know, the television coverage that I'm obviously involved in, but where it was when you played, you know, back at 53 to where it's come to now?
Well, the television, the big thing back then, they didn't have television, and they used to pack them in. We were in Barrie, in that old Dunlop Arena. You couldn't get a ticket. So when it wasn't on television, that the place was, like, we go to the Gardens. We would, the Maple Leafs would play the night before, and we played a doubleheader in the afternoon. We'd have about 500 more people than at the Toronto game. So it that way it was different. But now it's big time now. I mean, the way they put it on now. And, you know, I have to tell you something. I just came to me. I never realized how long the intermissions, not the intermissions, but the times outs are now until I coached. You know, you're watching television, you know, you have another pop or something or something like that. You know, but to stand, you know, you got things rolling, everything's going good and everything. And I never coached in the era where we had so much time. And it really is different than it is now, because now you can almost fall asleep back there and get. But in the old days, when they only had 30-second timeouts,
yeah,
you had to be sharp and had it on the fly and everything. But it really amazes me how the feel of the timeouts we have now.
Yeah, I'm curious as well, Don, if I can quickly go back to 53 and that Memorial Cup, and we'll get on to affairs of today in a second. The Winnipeg Amphitheater, for so long, that was the only artificial ice surface between Vancouver and Toronto. That was the only place to play. That was the only place you could play with artificial ice. What was that old barn like?
It was like one of those old barns, like the old Windsor barn. Remember how the atmosphere was in there? It was like the Dunlop Arena in Barrie.
5,000.
You walked in and you felt hockey. You know what I mean? It was all different ice surfaces. And you could, I don't know, the smell of it, the ammonia or whatever it was. And the crowd was right on you. Like, and you didn't have the glass, away glass up at the side, and you had a screen at the back. It was almost like you were right in. You could hear the crowd talking to you. It was, they were right in the game. It was a lot better. I know you have to have glass and all that stuff now and everything, but those buildings were hockey. You could just feel it when you walked in. You walked in the lobby, you were ready for the game.
Would you be in touch with any of those guys to a current day?
No, I don't know. I Ralph Willis is my best friend. He's in St. Catharines, and I don't see him much. He was my defense partner in all through that series, he was my roommate, Billet with him on Chatterton Street, I think it was. And then I went to Hershey. He was my defense partner. But, you know, you go your separate ways. You don't see him. Jimmy Robertson, he just died. He was a great guy of mine. He was in some St. Catharines. I tell you what a story he did. Hap sent me out. Well, I shouldn't say that. I asked to go to Windsor, and he said, bring your bag. This is no kidding. He said, bring your bag Thursday. He just put me on the bus and back to Windsor, and I got off, and the Mickey Drouillard, I remember the names now, the coach for Windsor, he went back to Detroit, and here I am standing here about 4 in the morning, no place to go, didn't know a hotel, never been away from Barrie and Kingston. And I remember Jimmy Robertson said, well, you come and stay with me, and I don't know what I would have done, but I didn't see him much either. I went to live in with Mrs. Scove, you know, the Scove, Glenn Scove and Elmer Scove, they played for Detroit, and I lived with them in, 1964 Francois Road. So it was a lot different back then. Back then we were... Wow. We didn't have much education. You know, they let us quit. I quit. My biggest mistake ever made in my life, quitting when I was 17 years old. My mother cried. And now you get the education. Now you have to go to school. If you don't go to school, if you skip, you'll miss games. And they keep an eye on you. And it's a thousand times better than it was back when I played.
Let me ask you about a couple of players specifically. One with Barrie, Don, and two with Windsor. With Barrie, how good was Orville Tessier? And with the Windsor Spitfires, how were Al Arbour and John Muckler as players?
Well, you know, it's a funny thing. That Orville Tessier, he was so good, he would stand, he could say in the warm-up of the game, and he'd say, watch, I'll step over the blue line and I'll ring it off the goalpost. And he could do it every time. He was a goal scorer's goal
Amazing.
Scorer. I think now he'd be dynamite because it was, how do I say, hockey was a little rough back then, and Orville didn't like the rough going too much, if you know what I mean. But now he would fit right in. I bet you he'd get 30, 40 goals now. And Muckler was a steady defenseman, stay-at-home defenseman, and Al Arbor was the same. Al Arbor's the best I ever saw blocking shots. He could block those shots. He's maybe the best I ever saw. And Muckler was one of those stay-at-home defensemen. He hardly noticed, just got it up like Bill White and guys like that. And you could always depend on him killing penalties.
How do you feel about the game and where it is today? I mean, obviously, having coached and played and what you see in minor midget, the Canadian Hockey League, how do you feel about the game today and where it's evolved to?
Well, there are things I'm not happy about. I'm not happy about the instigator rule. You guys know about that. And I don't like to see guys like Crosby getting crucified out there and being run and having to put up with everything. If you look back at Gretzky when he played, when they had Simico and McSorley, he had a credit card out there, and I think people like to see that. They go there with pay the big money. They don't want to see guys like Crosby being cross-checked and speared and stuff like that, and they get away with it now. And all the stars now, for some reason, they leave Stamkos alone. I don't know why, but I'm glad they do. But anybody else, anybody's a star, the first thing they do now is take a run at them and the Stahl brothers, you know, they're always hurt. The guys, all the stars, when 1 year were all out. The instigator rule, it was the worst rule ever put in sports because we used to be able to protect our stars, and now you can't. You get 2, 5, and a 10, you get a couple that they don't understand. They just don't understand that the instigator rule stopped protecting all the stars. And other than that, the players are bigger, and I don't know if they're smarter. They can shoot harder. They definitely shoot harder. Everybody can shoot harder, so that's the difference. Everybody bigger, everybody skate faster and shoot harder. Don't know if they're as smart, though. That's the one thing.
Don, you know, I get a chance to talk to you Saturday evenings before the big show, and you're always talking about, I was at this rink, and I saw this player, and I was at this barn, and I saw this guy, and you really got to check out this team. How many nights are you out watching kids play hockey?
Oh, Tim and I go out 3 nights a week, and we even some games, they're in the playoffs now, we go out 3 nights a week, and then I come home and watch the late show, late game here. So every night, every day I watch hockey and everything. And, you know, you ask me what's my biggest thrill watching hockey, and I think some people think I'm kind of phony this way, but I swear to God, I think the biggest kick I get out of going to minor midget and going to the games is seeing the kids at 9:30 at night, the Bantams going home because they played before, and they all have shirts and ties. I used to absolutely get a thrill out of that, to think that the mom and dads get us, they make them, and the kids love it. That's the big thing. They're not made, and if they see me coming, if they got their shirts, got their ties down, they'll do up their shirts. I mean, I just get a thrill even talking about it. There's no other sport in the world, none in the world, that makes their young kids wear shirt and tie to the games, and the guys love it. And that's my biggest thrill when I go to the games, when I see them walking out. And because I'll tell you, sometimes, yeah, they're 9:30 at night, and it's freezing. Especially the Etobicoke rink that Tim goes to all the time. We're actually standing on ice at the time. But that's my biggest thrill, watching the kids walk out and looking sharp and beautiful jackets and stuff like that. They look sharp. And that respect for the sport and respect for yourself. And I see, you know, the other day, maybe about a couple of weeks ago, and there was a tournament on. It was a team, hey, Graves, come on, can we have our picture taken? And they're all in T-shirts and everything. And they, hey, you guys, where's your shirts and ties? What are you, you know? And it was a team from Detroit. Kind of felt bad after that, but.
You know, I run into a lot of guys and scouts and so on and so forth. And the one thing that fascinates me about today's kids in the game is that they play all year round, and that kind of bothers me a little bit. And, you know, it's more keeping up with the Joneses, and we have to do the spring and this and that. I find that kids miss out on playing other sports. How do you feel about the all year round thing?
Well, you know, I would like them to play. I never played lacrosse myself because I don't know how to play it, so I'm not pumping. But it seems to me if they played lacrosse, they'd be better hockey players. And if you look at the guys like Crosby and guys like that and Gretzky, they all played lacrosse. They know how to spin away all the time when they're being cross-checked or something like that. So I would like to see them play lacrosse. But, you know, it's a funny thing. I know what people say. They should get them away, and they should come back. Bobby Orr is a great one for that. Bobby, you talk to him. He doesn't want them to, you know, he wants them to have the dry skates. You know what that's like. He doesn't like to take the kids. He thinks they should get away and not get sick of it. You know what I mean? And be hungry when the season starts. So It's tough to tell a kid, though, if he comes to you and says, look, Dad, I want to play 3-on-3. What are you going to say? No. It is tough, but I would like to see them away about a month anyhow, just to get a little hunger back.
And, Don, we'll conclude with this one as we look forward to the top prospects game. What are you most looking forward to, and is the answer beating Bobby Orr?
Well, I don't know what's going on. I just can't seem to beat him the last 5 years. I hate to tell you this. They give me the pick of the teams, and I don't know. I don't know what Brian and I are doing. It's got to be coaching or something. We had McKinnon the last time, and we still lost. But I said, this time I'm giving him McDavid. We're trying to reverse the psychology. So I love beating him. I have a big kick out. I think I take it more serious than he does. He really has a good time, and he kids with the kids, so... I think I take it a little more serious than Bobby, but I love it when I get him after. I really do like winning the game, to tell you the truth. It's a good feeling. And if you're a coach for a long time, like I was, and you lose, I have to tell you, you're really pissed off, to tell you that. I know it's hard to believe, but I am. I tell you, and I'm going to beat him this time, even with McDavid.
Oh, that's outstanding. That's remarkable, Don.
It's one of the huge... One of the huge thrills for me is this event every year, not only to get to spend time with you and see Killer and Bird again, but just overall spending time with the kids. So I'm looking forward to getting down to Niagara here in the St. Catharines area and seeing you over the next couple of days.
Great. Well, we'll see you guys at the we're going down Tuesday, and we'll see you at the practice here. I'd love to see you.
Yes, indeed. We'll catch up then. Thanks so much for this, Grapes.
Okay, guys. Toodaloo.
Hi, I'm Seth Jones of the Nashville Predators, and I played for the Portland Winterhawks of the Western Hockey League.
Our next guest is a very busy man today, Sam Cosentino, so we should probably get right to him. The mid-season draft rankings have now been released from NHL Central Scouting. Dan Marr is ahead of that organization, and he joins us now. Dan, how are you today, sir?
Very good. How are you, gentlemen?
Doing great, thanks.
We are good. We are good. No surprise, we see Connor McDavid on top, Jack Eichel in at number two. After the World Junior Hockey Championships, has that gap in your mind gotten smaller or wider between the two?
I don't even know if I'd use the term gap, just because in our opinion, they're two different types of players. And the measuring stick from the World Junior performance, the teams will factor that in, and we will as well. But it certainly doesn't override the history and the knowledge that we have on the player. So I wouldn't say it made any significant difference, to be honest with you.
Dan, I love it when these things come out because you talk to people and, obviously people have their various opinions on players and where they should be, and there's so many now independent services. I think it's probably best to kind of explain Central Scouting's role because I think oftentimes it gets misunderstood as if it's in competition with some of the independents.
Yeah, we don't sell our list and, we don't need advertisers to, to sell our services. We work for the 30 NHL teams, and it's our job. They want us to identify players for the draft. They want us to distribute them in a mid-season ranking and a year-end ranking, just in the order that we see fit as to who has the best potential to be in the National Hockey League. They realize that over the course of the year that changes. So our finalists, various stages through our round by round, will have a different face come the final meetings. And we also maintain our players to watch list during the course of the season for the benefit of the NHL teams, where we keep the ABC going.
How challenging is it, Dan, to handicap the various leagues the players come from? You'll have one kid playing at Boston College, another playing in Seattle, another playing in Halifax, all different leagues. How does that factor into what goes into where that person is ranked specifically?
Well, I appreciate you asking that question because this is where the experience comes into play quite a bit, and it's hard for, just the fans of a certain league to try and comprehend how, like, a high school player could be rated ahead of a player that's playing major junior hockey. And it is difficult, but over time, you come to your – each scout comes to his own way to evaluate and factor in the different ways of projection with the player. And, like, good players are good players. And what we try and do is picture this player playing in the high school league, or picture the high school player playing in the CHL. How do you think the player would fare at this stage? And you have to factor in the experience level that he has. So we know, for example, someone going from Minnesota high school and that goes and plays Tier 2 hockey or makes a step up to the CHL hockey, that's a big step. So we know to allow some transition time. Same with the European players that come over. So we don't go to one game or a couple games in a row and let that say, okay, this is the type of player it is. We know that their game's going to grow. We know it's still going to transition. So the projection, it really comes down to, you know, what the scouts' experience is with these different age groups.
I'm always fascinated by this game, Dan, in that, you know, scouts will tell you, well, one game doesn't make a difference, and then all of a sudden 300 scouts and, you know, a bunch of GMs show up at this game in particular. And I'm not saying it's the be-all and end-all, but at some point you have to take this game in particular and the level of players that guys are going to play with and against. It has to wait in some factor. If I go back to your experience in Atlanta, you know, as the head guy there, how do you guys look at this game? How did you look at this game?
You're talking about the prospect game in particular?
Yeah, this game in particular.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. What's really nice about it, obviously you have all the best players in one spot, but a lot of teams have just held their midseason meetings or they're going to hold them immediately after the game, and they deliberately set their meetings to that respect. And what it allows is that the guy that has seen the player the most, that scout, will present the player to the rest of the staff. They may have only seen him once when they've crossed over on the league, but this area guy has seen him six or seven times. Or the guy that has crossed over maybe has seen him twice, and he may point out something that the area guy, just because he's seen him so much, hasn't really focused on. So you get that kind of dialogue and that impression of the player. Then everybody gets to come to the game and see him, and then they'll remember what the guy who's seen him the most, what he said. They'll remember what the crossover guy said. And it does help paint the picture of the player, but and also to your other point there, it is an opportunity for the general managers who don't have a lot of time to scout junior hockey during the season, just to get their heads wrapped around, this is the guy I've heard about, now I get to see him in person here, because more mistakes are made on one game scouting than not.
Oh, that's the truth. I can remember talking to one NHL amateur scout, and I asked him about where he likes or where he feels it's best to sit or stand when watching a player. And he said, when I'm watching defensemen, I want to be down low. When I'm watching forwards, I want to be more up high. What works for you, Dan?
Well, I like to watch one team from the goal out one period, then the other team the second period, then oftentimes for the third, I'll take a lower position just to be a little closer to the ice, a little closer to the action. And I know some scouts, they're adamant they want to sit in the middle at the red line and watch the game. So it's wherever you get the best view. You know, with the advancements where the netting has come in, a lot of guys have drifted from the corners over to the, you know, the neutral zone where they don't have any obstructions from the netting. They just have a hard time seeing through it. So it has changed a little bit, but everybody finds what works for them. But I do think there's value in moving around, changing your position.
Dan, I just want to talk specifically just about the process once again. And you know, we're trying to educate people here because oftentimes we'll run into coaches and they'll say, well, why isn't my guy picked? Why isn't my guy picked, you know, when there's an injury? Can you explain the process when a player gets injured, how the replacement player is selected for the top prospects game?
Yeah, the CHL, when the game first came about, they wanted to maintain an arm's length distance just to avoid any conflicts of interest and to avoid having to have teams petition their players for a spot on the team. So what we do is we send a blank sheet to the 30 scouting directors. We ask them to give us four goaltenders, 12 defensemen, 24 forwards, and they return that to us. And our job is just to tabulate all those votes in confidentiality. And first four goalies are the goaltenders that are selected in the game. The next 12 D-men, 24 forwards. And as has happened this year and in some previous years, injuries come into play. So we have to have a list of replacement players. We have that all prepared in advance. So the fifth, sixth goalie, they're the next two that are in line to get added to the game. Defenseman, it goes to the 13th, 14th, 15th, and so on. So this is all done in advance, and I still get the calls from player agents and the coaches, managers wondering if their player could be considered as a replacement because it only happens once a year and they just don't remember how it works. So I can appreciate that the fans really wouldn't know how it works as well.
Would those players, those replacement players, know in advance, like, okay, if, you know, this player goes down, okay, Matthew Barzal is not playing, so Blake Spears, you're going into the game. Would he know that beforehand, or would that be a last minute thing
no.
that goes down?
Yeah, that's not the policy. We just, once we can confirm that, you know, the player has to be 100% cleared to play, but he also has to be 100% ready to play. And you know, there's a couple players that could have been rushed into where it would have been their first game back, but are they really at 100% game ready? And, you know, you don't want to have this game where it results in an injury for anyone, or you don't really want to put them in a situation. If they're not at their best, they're not going to come and look their best. So we're very cognizant of that. We work closely with the teams and with the agents. And but back to your point, no, the players, they're just happy to get that, you know, surprise phone call over the weekend. Tell them to pack your bags and come to St. Catharines.
So Dan, you come out with your midterm list, which was released today. What's the process for you guys moving forward? Do things change at all here in the kind of unofficial second half of the season as to where you go and your viewings from here on down the stretch? What's the process now for Central Scouting from here until we get to June?
In the second half of the season, the majority of the scouting is what we call crossover scouting, where the Eastern scouts head west and vice versa. We've had healthy discussions on the players, so we've created a little bigger book of knowledge on them, and our scouts will have that in mind when they go out and see them for that second time. And this all leads up to our accumulation at our final meetings. They still maintain contact with their areas, but the crossover scouting really gets emphasized in the second half because players have been identified, and other players have been identified. We want to see how much they improve in the second half. Or we've taken a position, well, we're not going to put him in this round or we're not going to put him on the list yet. We're going to make him earn it. We think he has a chance, but we're going to make him earn it in the second half. So it's a lot of legwork in the second half of the season.
A couple of players specifically, and it seems as if, at least online, battle lines have been drawn between these two. You're either in one camp or the other. Lawson Kraus and Mitch Marner, one for Kingston, one for London. A lot of hockey observers will look at Marner's numbers and say, how come he's not there underneath Hanifin? Others who would look at Lawson Kraus's complete game and project out to when he's 25 say, well, Central has him in the right spot. How did you arrive at Kraus at 4 and Marner at 7?
Well, for the midseason here, nothing's etched in stone. And on our discussions, 4, 5, 6, and 7, Kraus, Dylan Strome, Zach Werenski, and Mitch Marner, they're all interchangeable. And, you know, Matthew Barzal could very well be in that mix once he gets back playing in the lineup. And, you know, we have an electronic voting system that we use initially, then we have discussion, then we have hand votes, and they're all close. And right now this is just how our vote ended up and through our discussions. A lot of times you can take these players and say, well, what if Mitch Marner was playing on Kingston? What if Lawson Kraus was playing on London? You know, you can project those different scenarios there and just see how the argument goes. But right now, we know that those players are interchangeable, and there probably will be a change when our final list comes out.
What do you specifically like about Lawson Kraus? The size, what is it about Kraus specifically?
Well, his game continues to get better every time you see him. And his skating, he's always been a strong skater. Now he's a powerful skater. And his stride is really evened out. He gets there first. He's hard to check. He can protect the puck as good as anyone. He's got a good shot. Right now, what we find is that his supporting cast there, he's doing a lot of the work. He's not being fed the puck a whole lot. So his scoring chances come from him generating the chances on his own. In a different lineup and a different environment, there his numbers could actually, we would project them that they would be higher.
So, Dan, I want to move forward a little bit, and you and I chatted the other day and talked a little bit about the NHL Combine. It moves to Buffalo now, which we're, you know, it's going to be a new experience for everybody. I know there's a lot of planning that goes into it. How has that event evolved? I mean, I know under your tutelage it's evolved some, but where do you see this event going? I mean, you look at the NFL and it becomes this huge TV thing, and, you know, we're the rights holders at Sportsnet now, and I'm assuming there's going to be a TV element this year to it, but where do you see this thing going to?
Well, the NFL, their model of the combine, it is different than the NHL, obviously, because of the sports and more so because of the age of the athletes involved. We have high school students, 17 and 18-year-olds. The NFL, they have college players that are 23, 24, been through a collegiate career already, and they actually have 2 to 3 months to prepare for the combine. And just the timing of our combine, it goes in tandem. It's right after the Memorial Cup. So some players have had a lot of time to prepare, others haven't. We try and balance that out. And that's one of the reasons why we don't have an on-ice component. The combine is for the benefit of the 30 teams to prepare for the draft. So we're not, it's not a, you know, a made-for-TV type production. But there are elements to it where there's the fan interest is terrific. And what we've done is we did a comprehensive review of the combine with all 30 teams. We did that last season, and we have started the transition, the thoughts, just to kind of upgrade the combine and to move it forward. Some of our testing this year, there's going to be a lot more of technology involved in it. We're transitioning in some new tests and removing some older tests. Just over time, there's just in the scientific world with sports medicine and strength sports training, there's been a lot of changes and advances to the game. So we've got a committee with the strength coaches that we've actually let them set the tests that are going to be done at the combine. We have a combine committee of management and scouting directors that we review the protocols and the type of test that we'd like to see for the benefit of the team. So we are moving it in a forward direction. We're moving it to the Harbor Center in Buffalo, which is a tremendous facility. It allows us to be all under one roof. So anything we need to do, we don't have to send the players anywhere. It can all be done on site. And if the future does dictate an on-ice component, then we'd be ready-made because we have 3 ranks available to us right there in Buffalo. And the other part that the fans and the media don't participate in is the medicals are one of the key components. So we do an extensive medical screening, and, you know, as medical technology advances, so do the different tests and screens. So it's quite comprehensive medical that the players go through. And then there's the interview process where the 30 teams have access to all 120 invites. And that takes up, you know, the majority of the week where the players are going from team to teams with the interviews.
If I'm a player, Dan, like Connor McDavid, what could I possibly gain by having a good showing at the combine?
Well, again, this is a message we're trying to get out there. It's not a competition, and the players aren't being graded. What the testing, fitness testing part of the combine is to let the 30 team strength coaches and the scouting staff just see where that player is in his athletic development at age 17 and 18. Look to see what areas of weakness there are and determine, does he have the frame? Do they think they can train him to improve, to become a better NHL prospect or become an NHL player? And when you deal with his age group and you deal in sports, you know, competition is natural. But there's really no losers in this. So, like, you know, there's not as far as gaining or losing anything, that doesn't really factor in. Like, a very few teams will take these results and use them to in a negative fashion towards the player. If the player doesn't test well, chances are you already expected him probably not to test well, just because you've got your history with the player and you've seen him, you know what his conditioning level's like or his strength levels are like. So we're trying to just get the message, oh, this is just for the teams to find out where that player is in his athletic development, and that's what the testing's all about. So it's important for the individual players.
What about the? You just mentioned briefly the on ice thing. Is that something that you would want to see, or do you get the sense from the 30 NHL teams that that's an area they'd like to go down with the combine?
We asked the teams that specifically, and you know, it was a strong majority that said, you know, we've watched these players for 10 months. We've seen them before. Putting them on the ice really would be a little redundant. It's not necessary for us to help prepare for the draft. And so right now, there's no mood to do that. And I'm not even certain that, you know, the players and their representatives, we don't have any indication from them that they feel it's necessary either.
Dan, last question for you. Let's get on with your busy day. 2003 is certainly the bar for quality of draft. How good is it this year?
Well, I like to think every year, and this year in particular, that you know the teams are going to get a good player in the first round that has a good chance to play in their roster sooner rather than later. And then, like every year, I don't think it's going to change. You'll go through the second round. There'll be some players left there. But the consensus from the scouting community is that it does drop off a little sooner this year. So the scouts and the teams that really have done their homework and find some players that they think are diamonds in the rough that just need a little more time, you know, once you get into the fourth, fifth round, I think it's all over the place. It's really wide open because it's not that deep in numbers. But the first two rounds, and when you go through NHL teams, I think over 70% of the drafted players that are in the NHL come from the first two rounds. I think this year is a good year. It's just the top end there. So, well, they're using the word generational player. So Connor McDavid certainly fits that.
Yeah, don't be shy. We all use it, Dan. Thanks so much for this. We'll see you in St. Catharines.
All right.
Thanks, Dan.
Take care, Jeff.
Hi, I'm Dion Phaneuf of the Toronto Maple Leafs. I played my junior hockey for the Red Deer Rebels of the Western Hockey League.
Our next guest, Sam Cosentino, is a standout for Swift Currents. He will also be part of the BMO CHL NHL Top Prospects game. Can't wait to have a look up close and personal with Jake DeBrusk. Jake, how are you today?
I'm doing really good. How about yourself?
We're great. Thanks so much for stopping by today. How much have you been looking forward to this game, and how do you balance excitement and energy with still giving your top performance?
Yeah, you know, it's kind of a tough thing. You know, you just got to keep it in the back of your head almost, but this is such a great event. It's really hard, honestly, to keep it in the back of your head. We had two games and two nights yesterday and the day before, so, you know, it's I knew it was coming up close, but I had to focus on the games. But, you know, it's just it's really exciting, and it's a great moment for me.
How cool is it now that one of your teammates, Glenn Godwin, was added just today, and to get to experience that with him, he must be pretty fired up. Are you guys looking forward to traveling in together?
Yeah, you know, he called me yesterday, and he told me, and I was just super excited for him. You know, we both worked really hard to get to this point, and now, yeah, like you said, now it's nice to just travel somebody to Ontario, and you know, it's gonna be a great experience for myself and him.
You know, I get to work with your father quite often here in Toronto at Sportsnet, and we always talk about you, as I'm sure you know. And I'm curious how much, because your dad always says, you know, I try to stay back as much as I can, let him have his own career, his own experiences. You know, I don't get in big conversations with his head coach Mark Lamb or anything. But how much has your dad sort of prepared you for what this year, not just, you know, the year with Swifty and the top prospects and, you know, trying to stretch into the playoffs as deep as you can go, and then hopefully the Memorial Cup for your squad, but the draft. Like, how much has your dad prepared you for this important season in your life?
Like you said, you know, he stayed back. He's given me some advice. You know, just give it all you can give. You know, work your hardest every day, and you know what, you can't really do much more than that. It's kind of what he's told me, and you know what, it's been working this year for me, and you know, he just said enjoy every moment of it, and yeah, he's really proud of me, and he's a good guy to lean on. You know, when things aren't going so well, I give him a call here and there, and you know, he's just a really great dad, and he's always there for me.
Jake, in my conversations with scouts, there are two names that come up as guys who have really risen to the top of the rankings: the Thomas Chabot, the defenseman out of St. John, who you will get to meet, and your name. What's been the difference for you this year to raise your game to the level where now all of a sudden you're being considered a first round guy?
Well, there's lots of things. Last year at the second half of the year, I got some more ice time, and I started putting up some points last year, and I kind of continued that this year. I think I'm around a point per game right now, so the points have been coming for me, and I've just been really working on my little details, I guess you could say, my defensive zone, really focusing on that. That's kind of one of the biggest thing in the game now today. If you can't play in the defensive zone, you can't really play anywhere. So I've been really focusing on that. And, I've been put out in lots of different situations this year, and I've thought that I've excelled, and I've really, really just been enjoying this year, and just got to keep it going.
Yeah, Mark's been putting you on the right side a little bit as well. And are you comfortable on the right side? Are you more comfortable in the middle, natural centerman? Where do you feel the sweet spot of the bat is for you?
I've, throughout my Western League career, I've only played wing. This year, like you said, I've gotten moved to right side. But before that, I played center, so I honestly can play any position. I like right side a little bit more, honestly, but I'm really easy. I'm comfortable on both sides, and I'm even comfortable at centerman. So he's been throwing me out there into different situations, and I've played all three.
Now, this thing has obviously been in the back of your mind, as you mentioned earlier. How much do you pay attention to the draft rankings, National Hockey League, Central Scouting, and then there's a bunch of, obviously, independents that put out draft rankings? I guess you can't help but pay attention to at least some of that.
Yeah, it's especially with the social media nowadays, with Twitter and all that stuff, I kind of get tagged in some tweets here and there, and I'll be honest, I glance at it a little bit, but you just gotta keep focused on the goal at hand, and just try to play your best, and like before I said, just work your hardest every day, and you can't really control what goes on around you, but if you work your hardest, you can only help yourself out. So I've just been trying to do that, but yeah, it's kind of hard, honestly, not to look at that stuff, but I use it as motivation, so it's been awesome.
Curious about your minor
name up there,
yeah,
in Central Scouting for sure.
That must be pretty neat. I'm curious about your minor hockey career as well, from Alberta to Arizona and back. When you were in Phoenix, I believe you played 3 years there. I believe you played a little bit with Austin Matthews. He may end up going first overall next year, and also Brendan Lemieux, son of Claude Lemieux. How are they as teammates to play with, to play against? How are they at that point?
You know what? They were really good special players, especially Austin Matthews. Sorry. He can't really, even back then, he just seemed to dominate the game. I don't remember too much, honestly, about those years, but I just remember that they were really good guys. Brendan was a guy that every single shift, he'd give his hardest out there. And Austin, I just remember being super skilled and really good players. So, yeah, it's kind of neat. I've met some guys even this year that I played in Phoenix with in the Western Hockey League. And it's kind of cool to see how small the world really is when it comes to hockey. And it's nice to see those guys doing well.
Jake, one of the big things about this game is the ability to translate what you do in Swift Current to this particular game, and that's tough for guys. So if I'm looking and watching the game on Thursday, what am I looking for from Jake DeBrusk that I would see on a nightly basis in Swift Current?
I'm just a guy that just plays upbeat. I like to play a fast game. I like to use my speed. So a guy that makes good plays in the offensive zone, has patience, has a good hockey IQ, finds the net. Another place that you could find me is in front of the net. That's kind of one of the biggest things I've been focusing on this year, is just going to the hard areas. So if you're going to be looking for something, just that's probably one thing that you can look for, is just my speed and just my willingness to go to the net for those, I guess, greasy goals. But you need those ones. So.
Jake, have you met Don Cherry before?
No, I haven't. No, I'm really excited to meet him, though. Yeah, it'll be a cool experience. I know he's met my dad, so he has a picture with my dad actually. It's at our house, of them both doing the thumbs up. So I'm hoping to maybe grab a picture of me and him doing the thumbs up. I think that'd be pretty cool.
I was going to say, have you rehearsed a conversation the first time you meet him yet? Because we just had him on the program a second ago, and he was talking about how the kids, really shy, really respectful, but still, really shy. What are you going to say when you meet Don Cherry for the first time?
Yeah, I honestly don't know. I'm just gonna, like you said, I'm just gonna be as polite as possible and just, just say hey. It's kind of, I don't know. I honestly can't tell you what I'm gonna do, but I think I'm gonna be one of those little shy people. But
that's awesome.
I'm sure he's pretty open.
When you look at the rosters and you see, I mean, obviously there's been a lot of talk about Connor McDavid, but is there any one particular player that you're interested in seeing that maybe you don't know a ton about that's on either roster?
Yeah, probably the player that stands out the most is Mitchell Marner. You know, I sometimes see some highlights on him and just really like how he plays. And, you know, I'd just be cool to – he's on my team, so it'd be kind of cool to see him and what he does. And, you know, he's having a really good year for London right now, so – that's probably one player that I'll be really kind of excited to see play, and him and Dylan Strom too. Dylan Strom's had a really great year, so it'll be really exciting seeing those two players.
No secret, Jake. Of course, this is a huge year for you. I'm curious, what's it like? Does it get annoying? Does it get frustrating when pretty much after every game there's a knock on the door and someone else, whether it's an agent, whether it's a scout, somebody wants to talk to you? What's that like?
I honestly think it's really, I'm really appreciative of it. Like, it's an honor to be talked to by any NHL team. You know, it gets pretty crazy sometimes, but honestly, I've been loving it. You know, it's been, it's always pretty cool when a team wants to talk to you, or like your agent, like you said. You know, it's just, it's nice. I honestly have just embraced it, and I enjoy it. So whenever it happens, it's just, it's nice for me. I really like it.
Hey, Jake, is there that element to your game that your dad featured with the fisticuffs?
only when he plays Regina, apparently, Sam.
Yeah, only when I play Regina, Brandon. Yeah, no, he doesn't really like me getting into those, I don't think. But no, we're not really similar. But if I'm not afraid to drop him if I have to, or if the team needs a lift, you know, I know as soon as I drop him, the boys will be either super pumped or they'll pretty much start laughing at me, and either way I'll get a reaction, so I know it's a good thing.
You know what?
Either way I know I'll get them going. So.
Let's finish up with a thought about your dad as we conclude the interview, Jake, and thanks for your time. What are the one, maybe two things that, you know, growing up in an NHL family, what are a couple of things that really helped you that you look back at now and say, you know what, because my dad was in the NHL, I learned this. A couple of things maybe that give you a leg up on some of the other prospects because you are a second-generation player?
Yeah, you know what? Probably the main thing is just that I'm always around the game. I've always been around the game my entire life. When I was 3 days old, I went to my first NHL game. So,
wow.
I've been around the rink since then. And, you know, even I don't really remember those times, but the times I do remember, even like the previous years, my dad's been working in like around the NHL and, you know, just always keeping up to date with the teams. And, you know, just I've just been always around the game. I just found that that's one thing that helps us out, is that we're just literally all around it. He's been a player. He's now an analyst. So I've been around the game for a while, and just the tips. You know what? He's gone through the experience of the Ontario Hockey League. He's gone through junior, so he was a really good helping hand there. And he also knows what it takes. So you know, yeah. I just take a lot from him there. So yeah, that's probably the two things.
And he's a wonderful guy as well. Jake, thanks so much for this. Yeah. Sam and I both look forward to seeing you, as do the rest of Canada and everyone watching on Sportsnet. Thanks a lot for this. Good luck on Thursday.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on the show. Really appreciate it.
Hi, I'm Joel Ward of the Washington Capitals, and I'm a former player of the Owen Sound Platers / Attack.
Being joined now by someone who played 401 games in the NHL, but before that, played seasons in the OHL for the London Knights from 88 to 1991. You can watch him on our Sportsnet broadcasts. Everybody knows the name. Everybody knows the personality. He is, of course, Louis DeBrusque, and he joins us here on the Junior Podcast. Louis, how are you today, sir?
Good, bud. How are you doing, Jeff?
Yeah, I'm good. And, you know, we were just off air a little bit talking about old London Knights stories. And
yeah.
I grew up with a guy named McKelly Kane. You played with him briefly in the in the OHL. But when you think back to your career, we'll go wide brush here, Louis. When you think back to your career with the London Knights and the seasons you played there before going to the NHL and turning pro, what's the first thing that comes to your mind when you think about your time in the green?
Well, you know what? I smile every time I think about it, because it's such an influential time in a young hockey player's career playing junior hockey, and especially your first couple of years being in that league. Everything is new. It's a tough league, and it's a great league, and you get to see so many different things while you're there. But for me, it was stepping on board in London. Came from a pretty small town in Port Elgin. Went to Stratford for a year, a little bit bigger town, then went to London, which was a little bit bigger. And I was actually a first-round pick, which was a surprise to me. I didn't really expect to go that high. which was for me a surprise. And then when I walked in there, it was just a great atmosphere. We had an old team my first year, so a lot of veteran players. We had a physical team, and we had a team that was one win away from going to the OHL championship that year. And that year, for me, was just it was a whirlwind, but it was an amazing experience from start to finish in my first year in the OHL.
Yeah, that was the year you guys bowed out in the semis against Niagara Falls, a big, strong, tough team.
Yeah, we were both big, strong, tough teams, and we had battles against the Falls. Brad May was Mayday played for Niagara Falls. They had some highly skilled players there. Obviously, Primo was lighting up the league at that time. Brian Fogarty was excellent on defense. I mean, they had a great combination of skill and toughness, which was the way the league was back then. And so did the London Knights. So did we. We had a lot of toughness. We had a lot of skill. So we went head-to-head with that team. They were great games to watch.
You know, one of my favorite players ever to watch, you just mentioned his name, Brian Fogarty, and there were so many Niagara Falls games where I just watched him grab the puck, and Louis, you were there, you played against him. He could, if he decided to, just take over a game. Like, there are so few players I've ever seen in junior that could just take over a game the way that Brian Fogarty could.
He really could, and you know, we think of defensemen from back in the day, Jeff, we always think of Bobby Orr. You know, Bobby Orr was the guy that changed the way the game was played, essentially, from the back end, the way he'd rush the puck up the ice and how he became a fourth forward and was a great enough scare to be back in the play and still defend. And Fogarty was much like that in junior hockey. He was that dominant. He would get a puck, and he could pretty much do what he wanted with it. The other thing that people forget about Fogarty is that, aside from being an excellent skater and having the skill set, he was a pretty big guy. He was a physical guy and wasn't afraid to be in the mix, so to speak. So he was very good at kind of brushing off the hit coming his way, getting to an area. They based the whole power play around him. He had an excellent year that year. He was fantastic. And one of those guys that we kind of said, we need to shadow. We have to have a guy on this standing beside this guy everywhere he goes on the ice. And even doing that, he still put up points.
Yeah, it was. Everyone's got a plan to neutralize Brian Fogarty and Junior until the puck actually drops, and then it's a different game. Hey, you mentioned your OHL draft, and you went 13th overall to London Knights. We'll go back to the 88 OHL draft. Drake Brahowski goes first to Kingston. Some big names in that draft that, you know, went on to big things in junior, big things in the NHL as well. Adam Foote was drafted after you. Owen Nolan was in that draft as well. There were some, like, that year with Bob Bugner goes to the Greyhounds at number 6 overall, John Slaney to Cornwall, like Rob Pearson about. There's some big names that went in that draft. What was your draft experience like in 88 for the OHL? Because I imagine it's much different now for the kids.
Well, and that's why I said that I didn't really know where I was going to get drafted. There just wasn't the hype and the publicity around the league. Now that there is now with all the platforms that people can follow games, can follow the league, can get information. Back then, we just played the game. There would be some scouts in the building. We might bump into one here and there, but we didn't talk to too many people. So it was kind of, it was a shock. It really was. And it was funny. It's funny that I'm now on TV and talk for a living, because my biggest fear once I got drafted 13th overall by the London Knights was that I had to get up and say a speech on the stage.
That's right.
You had to do the little speech in front of everybody. And I was like, oh, I was just dreading it getting up there. I said, you know, I actually have to go up there. Can I not go up there if I don't want to? But you know what? The amazing thing is that you mentioned some players that I battled for 3 years in junior. And, you know, Adam Foote is one of those guys. Bob Bugner is one of those guys. They were just big, hard-nosed guys to play against. And you went at them. Every time you played that game, and Drake Berhowski was the first overall pick that year, and he was a beast back there in the back end. I mean, there was just some really good players. Rob Pearson played a long time in the National Hockey League as well, and it was a strong league. You know, I remember at that time it was a little more condensed, I think. So you just had when players got drafted that high, they were just they were men amongst boys, I guess you could say. And that was kind of what I was, too. I was a big kid coming into junior and was ready to step in at 17, which is a little later than kids out west kind of step into the WHL.
Sean O'Donnell went to Sudbury that year in that draft as well. That's someone that I would imagine every time you guys matched up, that was someone that was a leave-it-all-on-the-ice kind of player, too.
Yeah, you know what's funny? You know, Sean was in Phoenix when I was doing the radio broadcast down there, and we've known each other ever since junior. And we'd always kind of bump into each other and chat. And he was one of those big, steady, stay-at-home guys that kept it easy. And I remember in Phoenix when he was on board there, and that was the first year after the lockout that they changed the rules. You couldn't clutch and grab. They were really bearing down on the sticks, the hooks, the trips, and things like that. And I thought, you know, physical stay-at-home defensemen are really going to suffer from this. Mm-hmm. And what an amazing turnaround for him to be able to last as long as he did. He just adjusted his game and proved that he was a lot better than maybe people gave him credit for. He was a guy that lasted for a long time, won a Stanley Cup in Anaheim, went into L.A., and you know what? He's one of those guys that really elongated his career by just making a few subtle adjustments and playing that steady game. But, yeah, Sudbury was a tough building to go into. They had that wolf that used to fire down whenever they'd score the goal.
They still do. They still do, Louis. They still have the wolf. Oh, yeah, they still have the wolf.
And you know, every time we went in there, we're like, there's no way that wolf's coming out tonight. But they always found a way to get it out there. We did have one game, I believe, that we shut them out 3-0 in there during my career. We were pretty excited about that in London, not to have the wolf come out.
Kept the wolf in the den, and now O'Donnell now doing some TV work for the Los Angeles Kings.
Yeah,
hey, that draft year as well. Chris Taylor goes in the third round. Yep. You play with the London Knights. Outstanding. Did you play Stratford with him? Were you guys Carltons at the same time?
You know what? I think he played a few games that year. He didn't play the entire year in Stratford. He went right to he came up and played some games with us. Timmy Taylor, his older brother, was actually in London my first year too, and he was the best player on our team. Just a tremendous player that won a couple cups with Detroit and Tampa Bay later on in his career. Chris was much like his brother, a little bit bigger than Timmy. And, I mean, his junior numbers were outstanding. Chris Taylor in junior was just a fantastic player. And, I mean, he had a good long pro career, too. He jumped around a lot, but he was always one of those guys that people wanted in their organization because of how skilled he was. The last time I saw him, he was doing some coaching down in Rochester. He's an assistant coach with the American Hockey League team down there. And I'm not too sure if he's still in that capacity there, but just a great hockey mind. I was fortunate enough to play on the power play with him. You know, he was the half wall guy. I'd be the guy down low, and you knew every time he was going to get the puck down to you. That's how skilled he was. But
yeah,
what's that?
I was just going to say he was just inducted into the Rochester Americans Hockey Hall of Fame.
There you go. Yeah, and rightfully so.
Legendary.
Rightfully so. He really, and I mean, I was just kind of doing some research, looking at his numbers there as we were talking before, and I mean, he was a dominant player in junior. He really was.
Yeah, he was outstanding. When you played with the Culletons, I think you only played the 1 year there. I mean, the William Allman Arena, outside of Galt, that's the longest-running arena that hasn't been interrupted by anything. There was a 1 year where they changed the seats or they repainted the seats. But, I mean, that's a rink that you go back to, I think it was like 1922 or 1923, has never had an interrupted season. What was that rink like for you? I was there for Hockey Day in Canada a few years ago when I was working for CBC, but what was it like to play at the William Allman?
You know what? That was my first experience away from home, and I have nothing but fond memories of Stratford. That was a great building to play in, just an amazing atmosphere being the home team in that barn. And the fans were great. The organization was second to none, and they treated us incredible. It couldn't have been a better place to go for your first year away playing hockey, as far as I'm concerned. And that building itself, it had a life all of its own, and especially in the playoffs. When we get into the playoffs, it was rowdy, it was loud, it was like the fans were right over top of you. Mm-hmm. And you know what? Opposing teams, talking to guys later on, just hated coming into that building. And when you're a team that has a building like that, you love that. You love the fact that teams don't like coming into your barn. And that's what that building had. And you know what? I would have probably played more years there and potentially gone on to, you know, maybe a scholarship down in the States at the time, but just felt it was a better route for me to try and go junior, one of those decisions that kids are still making today. It worked out, but I would have gladly gone back and played multiple years in Stratford. That's how great my experience was there.
Yeah, legendary organization and rich in history. I mean, how often did the name Howie Morin? How often did the name Howie Morin's the Stratford streak, even though he wasn't from there? How often did the name Howie Morin's come up?
Yeah, you know what? And it's funny because I played with Rick Olchuk there. Rick Olchuk, general manager in Carolina. He was in Edmonton. His older brother, obviously Ed. Yep. Was a long-time National Hockey League player and a great player at that, and he does the TV in Chicago now on NBC in the States. And, you know, he would come and visit us at times. and just the culture there. You know, they really did like to look at the guys that have played there. They had the older pictures on the walls there, so you could look around on the walls when you walked around. They loved to keep that culture in the building. And I remember it always being a real special time when Ed would come back and visit Rick, and he'd come in the dressing room and give the guys a little bit of the speech and kind of pump us up before games. And, you know, it was just a terrific place to play.
Are you a pack rat? I mean, I collect a lot of things from hockey, and I would imagine if I ever played, I would have saved every puck, every T-shirt, every dry fit, every hat, do you still have stuff from London and from Stratford kicking around?
I've got some stuff. Yeah, my mom actually gave me a little bit of stuff that she had collected over the years that I had and kind of thrown there. And you know, it's one of those things, and I'm sure you've heard it from other guys too, Jeff. They say, "Geez, I wish I would have kept this," or "I wish I would have made more of an effort to try and pick up a stick here, or there, or a you know something." But I do have some things. You know, it's funny. I've moved around a lot in the last 10 years, so things are still in boxes and in the garage and stuffed into places and still haven't been unpacked and put up on walls. But you know what? I always tried to grab a couple of things, and I do have a Knights jersey. I still have a Knights jersey because I love that green and gold. It was funny story, you know, back when I was playing in midget in Fort Ogden, we had like the New York Ranger type colors in our midget team. And, my dad, you know, always looking for a good deal, went to the one sporting goods store that we had in town there, and he had to order this pair of gloves in for me. So they sent in a pair of gloves, and they were green gloves with gold trim.
And, no way.
Yeah, and the guy, it was a mistake, so he gave him like half off the gloves. So my dad was like, "There's no way I'm passing up this deal." He buys these green gloves for me. So I had to wear green gloves, even though our uniforms were nowhere near that color. And I remember saying to him, "When am I ever going to play on a team that has to wear green gloves?" And later I was playing for the London Knights, which was kind of funny.
Now, when you played at London, was it called the Ice House Center, or was it still Treasure Island Gardens?
It was called the London Gardens.
It was called the London Gardens,
yep. And because that was another rink, believe it or not, talking with players over the years. It's funny, you reminisce about your junior days, as you often do. And them coming down the highway and seeing the gardens off the 401 there and pulling in there, it was outside of town a little bit. It was a little, you know, kind of dingy road that went into the gardens. And you know, people didn't like that bar either. They did not like coming and playing in the London Gardens. I didn't realize at the time, obviously, we tried to make it a tough place to play in. But they would, you know, drive down the highway, and they said, you know, is this like, you know, here we go again. We got to go into this barn again. But we had terrific fans there as well in London. They were fantastic when that place was full. It had a life of its own. It really did. And that's probably the most special thing about junior teams and respective buildings is they take on a life of their own, and that's what makes them unique.
You know, it's interesting, too. When that rink closed, the Windsor Spitfires bought all the seats to put in their barn in the Windsor Arena. So a piece of London for years lived on in Windsor.
Isn't that amazing? Such a heated rivalry, too. I remember going into Windsor the first time. That was the first exhibition game I ever played was in the old Windsor Arena there. And Jim Revenberg and I dropped the gloves the first shift, you know, and squared off at center ice. And I just remember the place was wild. Like, it was just, that was a wild barn. I remember Dennis Purdy a couple of years later got in a penalty box, and the fans were coming up over the glass, and it's just a vivid memory for me to see Dennis Purdy just swinging right hands with some guy, you know, that was probably twice his age, you know, in the stands, just swinging away. And there were some crazy things that went on back then, you know, especially in that building, especially when London and Windsor met up. It was a real heated rivalry.
No, it was complete. Now, did you ever cross paths? I'm trying to put the years together here. Did you ever cross paths with a guy by the name of Tom Sullivan, who played with Windsor, only played a couple of years.
I bought him, actually, but it was when he was with Detroit.
He played for Detroit for one year, and then Windsor, I think, maybe for two. He had this one with Ryan Vandenbosch at the old Windsor bar. Maybe you've seen it on YouTube.
I have actually seen it.
Okay, so like the punch count is up around 90. I talked to Vandenbosch about it years later, and he said he was so sore that the trainers had to cut his shoulder pads because he got back to the room and he couldn't lift his arms up to get his shoulder pads off. What was Tom Sullivan like to scrap?
You know what? I remember him being really strong. And you know, I was a big guy in junior, and that was one of the strengths that I had, was I was a really strong guy, and I could usually kind of put a guy in a position that I wanted. Even if I was maybe behind in the fight, I could weather it and eventually get control of the fight. But right. I remember him being really strong. And I think at that time, though, I'm pretty sure I'm a little older than him, so I had a reputation. He was stepping up. I think at that time he wasn't as big as I was, but he was. I remember him being really strong, and I honestly can't remember how the fight went, but I think it was a pretty good one. I think it was.
Oh
okay,
yeah,
But I remember him being very strong.
Big strong guy too, and he was a trained boxer as well, which really served him well for a lot of years. I remember watching your career, and you know, I can only say this about a couple of people. I never saw you handled. I never saw you buckle. I never saw anyone handle Louis DeBrusque. Who was the toughest guy you went up against in the OHL?
Well, you know what? I it's funny because I kind of came in and it was gunslinger mentality back then. You went in.
Yeah.
There was always a few guys on the other side that you could engage in. And being a young guy, I was like, okay. And the older guys would tell you who the tough guys were. Watch out for this guy. He's a lefty or whatever. There was no video to watch to get any scouting reports on players. So you kind of went into every fight just saying, you know, I'm going to swing away and see what happens. And the guy that got me... The first guy that really got me good was Dennis Viel, actually. You know, he was you know, a veteran guy in the league and played a long time in the National Hockey League. And we fought a few times over our career. And he was, you know, he was a tough individual. And Brad May and I talk about him all the time, just how he was one of those guys that seemed to get better as the fight went on. But, yeah, he got me in London Gardens really good one night. And I actually had to miss a game. It was the first games that I think I had to miss because of my neck. He missed a few shots and hit me in the neck so I couldn't turn my head. And then I remember going back into Niagara Falls and for the rematch, and the guys were just ribbing me. Like, the whole bus ride to Niagara Falls are like, I can't believe you lost to him. And, you know, the older guys just getting you riled up before the game.
Oh, yeah.
And I think I ended up fighting Mayday instead, though, because Bill LaForge was on the bench, and he was smart that way. He was tactical, and he would send waves of guys after you. And Mayday was just, you know, that guy would fight anybody in junior. It didn't matter who was in front of him. And,
that's right.
You know, he was a scrapper, like real good scrapper.
How many times did you go Mayday? Because I know there was at least two.
I think we fought five or six times in junior and once in the NHL.
Right.
Yeah, I think it's around there. For sure. For sure, five or six in junior though, and I think we fought three times our rookie years because we were rookies together. So. But yeah, you know what? It was that's what made the games exciting though, was because, and we were talking about the other night, we were on Hockey Central together, and we in the old barn in Niagara Falls, the bench was across the way, and he talked about how Bill LaForge would bump up the bench and make it higher than the opposition's bench, so they looked bigger. They had those black uniforms that made them look mean. They pumped Thunderstruck, AC/DC in there, and you know, it was just a real, like, you went in there, it was, you know, put your A game on because it's going to be a tough one tonight. And then I remember looking across, and that's why they essentially started to change that, was that stare down that went across the ice. And I remember having stare downs with Mayday, and next thing you know, we're out in the ice fight.
Well, and LaForge too. I mean, was, you know, one of the late Bill LaForge was one of those coaches that, you know, looked for any advantage psychologically or physically. Were you in the league when he got caught shaving the guy's visors down to a point?
You know what? I think I was, yes. That might have been right around that era.
And yeah, because there was...
So it would nick your knuckles up, so it would cut your hand
and
hit it.
Well, there were a couple things. He got nailed with the shaving down the visors to a point. Okay, he got caught with that. And so he was so incensed. First of all, he didn't want any of his guys to wear visors in the first place. But then he was so incensed that he got caught doing that when he had to put the regular visors back on, he had the trainer, instead of screwing them from the outside in, almost like Frankenstein style, it looked like, had the trainer screw them from the inside out. So if you went to punch one of his guys and you missed, you'd slice open your arm punching him.
You'd have the bolts sticking. You know, say what you want about Bill LaForge. The one thing you can definitely give him credit for is he was innovative. He loved to be cutting edge as far as the tactics that he would use and psychologically trying to get into his opposition. But on the other side of it, too, he protected his players. He really did. He was hard on his players. He demanded a lot from his players, but he would do everything in his power to protect his players and give them an advantage. And I recall one time, actually, the fight we just talked about with Dennis Vial, I had challenged him three times in that game, and he wouldn't fight me. He wouldn't fight me. And I was a young guy. I was a rookie. So obviously I was more eager than he was early in the game to try and get something going. But then later on in the game, Bill LaForge sent him out there when it was time to fight. And when he sent him out there when it was time to fight, he was ready. You know, he had his chin strap taped up really tight. He had his helmet pulled down like he was ready for the fight. And he actually caught me off guard. And I always remembered that. I always remembered the fact that, you know, he was ready and I wasn't. I thought that that threat was gone in the game, but it wasn't. And that was just a real good tactical movement by Bill LaForge to put him out there at that time. And Brad May speaks very highly of him. Some players didn't like the way he coached, but some players, they swear that he made their careers as well.
Yeah, 100%. I remember talking to Keith Primo about him last year, as a matter of fact. And he, as much as some of the things he did were controversial, you know, Keith said this guy really cared about his players. Yep. And he made a lot of those players better players going through the Bill LaForge experience. Who are, in your estimation, when you look back at your time with London, and there were some biggies. I mean, that was, as you mentioned, Wild Wild West territory. Who are some of the more notable heavyweights in the OHL at that point?
Ooh, you know what? You know, when I broke into the league, there was still the Ty Domi was still in the league. He played in Peterborough. Yep. We never played against each other. He was he hurt his ankle that year. And actually, after that fight with Dennis Vial, the game I missed was against Domi, or else we probably would have fought for sure in junior. Because he was still, in my opinion, at that time, the reigning champion or right up there. I mean, he was one of the guys that, you know, had that reputation in the league, and rightfully so for Ty. And then, you know, John Van Kessel out of North Bay was a big, tough individual. Sean Antoski was in the league at that time. Darian Hatcher was young, but just coming up in the ranks, and he was a big guy. There was, you know, every team seemed to have that real big, tough guy. Chris Simon was young. He came in a couple years after me, or a year after me, and he was starting to make waves, too, and became, you know, obviously a really tough guy in the National Hockey League for a long time. But, yeah, you know what? It was a different brand of hockey back then. It was way more physical. I don't want to say it was dirtier. I just think that it was you just knew it was going to be a tough night. Most nights there was going to be a couple scraps.
Do you remember a guy, and he didn't do it very often, but when he did, was it something? He was a defenseman that played for Owen Sound with the Platers. I'm not sure if you guys overlapped. Do you remember a guy named Sean Kruger?
You know what? I'm not sure. It's not ringing a bell for me. But, okay. No. There was a guy, though, speaking of London Knights, Brett Doherty was a guy like that I remember always hearing about. And I used to, you know, Don Brankley was a trainer there for, you know, 40 years, and he had stories on every guy that ever came through there, and he used to tell me about guys back in the day. And, like, that's back in the Rob Ramage, you know, Marsh days, and, you know, before that, Dino Ciccarelli. So you heard about all the old great players in London. But Doherty was one of those guys, and I remember seeing a fight with him and Bob Babcock. Remember Big Bad Bobby Babcock?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
you know, that was another guy that was in the league, played for Cornwall my first year, and he was a monster. And Brett Doherty was not a big guy. He was just a little guy. Like, if you looked at him out of his hockey gear, you wouldn't think anything of him, but he just chopped down the giant. And it
really?
That was one of the old videos that I actually got to see, and I was always so amazed at how he just, it looked like he was going to get killed, and then all of a sudden, the Energizer Bunny just, it was like Ryan Vandenbush, you know, just started throwing, and once he started, he didn't stop until the big guy was down.
You mentioned Don Brankley a couple of seconds ago, and I got a chance to spend a lot of time with him last year at the MasterCard Memorial Cup, hosted, of course, by the London Knights. What was he like as a trainer for you? Because still to this day, I mean, you know, I mean, he still runs the town. He's still legendary there.
He is. You know, we talked about Windsor and that battle between London and Windsor, and he was the one that would usually incite the fans in Windsor and get them going. And, you know, they wanted a piece of him as much as they wanted a piece of us. But the one thing about Branks is that he always had the players' backs. You know, he was always there to make sure that your equipment was perfect, your skates were perfect, whatever sticks you need. I mean, one of the best, if not the best, trainer in the business for three, four decades. And it was attention to detail. He really cared about his players, wanted them to have the best and wanted them to be treated the best. And a big reason why he was there for so long.
It is certainly true. Okay, let's fast forward quickly. We talked about your OHL draft. What about your NHL draft? Your 1989, you're drafted in the third round by the New York Rangers. How is it different than your OHL draft?
You know what? It was similar in a couple of ways. This is a funny story, actually. My mom and dad just came in from London, and we had lunch today, and we were talking about it. And, you know, with my son being draft eligible this year, we were discussing the draft and just talking about it. And the day before the draft in Minnesota in 89, I was on the roof shingling the Friday afternoon and in Port Elgin, Ontario. And I don't have to say Ontario here because we're in Ontario. But I got a call from then coach and GM Wayne Maxter, who is the coach and GM of the London Knights, and asked me why I wasn't in Minnesota for the draft. And, you know, I explained to him that my agent thought it might not be good because I had to be drafted in the first three rounds back then. And didn't necessarily know if I was going to get drafted. And he said, well, I think you are. So we arranged for a flight. I got rushed to Toronto, jumped on a plane, stayed at Basil McRae's house with Branks, and the next day got drafted to the New York Rangers 49th overall. So it was kind of just a whirlwind day. It was the first time I was ever on an airplane myself. I mean, I was so lucky to get to Minnesota because I went through Chicago, that O'Hara Airport. I had to run all the way around. The only way that I got on that plane was that there was a flight attendant that was on my plane that was getting on that plane, and she pretty much held my hand the whole way to get there. So just a funny story there. But, again, just a different time where you just didn't really know what teams liked you. You didn't know where potentially you might go unless you were an elite player and you knew you were going to be drafted high. It was pretty much a crapshoot. We just didn't have the intelligence, I like to call it, that we have today as far as people knowing so much about the game, the scouting they do now, the video you can watch. It's just so much different. It was a different time.
It was. I want to ask you one more thing about your NHL career, and then I want to talk about your son. I was on the podcast today as well. Part of the Messier deal, some players have a feeling they know when they're going to be traded. Others, it's a surprise. What was it like for you?
Yeah, it was a surprise. I know that Neil Smith, who was on the show last night with me, and the GM that traded me, he got Mark Messier back. So he was smart, and he made the wise decision to do that as they won the Cup in 94. But for me, again, I was a young guy in New York, and it was the first year that I was eligible to play in the American Hockey League. I played a couple games at the end of the year previous down there in Binghamton. We had a pretty good playoff run down there. And then coming into training camp that year, I knew there was I was either going to be in New York or I was going to be in Binghamton. My junior days were over. And the day that I got sent down, the very next morning, I was traded to the Edmonton Oilers. So it was one of the last cuts from New York that year. So it was a little bit disappointing for me because I really felt there was an opportunity for me to play in New York.
Right.
But it worked out well. Glenn Sailor got on the phone and told me he was bringing me right into Edmonton instead of sending me down to Cape Breton for the time being, and I got to go right to Edmonton and play my first game in Los Angeles a few days later.
That's outstanding. I want to talk to you about Swift Current. They have a player there who's ticketed to go in the NHL draft this year. His name is Jake DeBrusk. And I know you're proud when people say, hey, there's Louis DeBrusk, who played 400 games in the NHL. You're probably proud to say, hey, there's Louis DeBrusk, a broadcaster with Sportsnet. But how proud are you when you say, hey, that's Jake DeBrusk's dad?
Yeah, you know what? It's icing on the cake. That's the best part of it. You know, it's been for my wife and I and our daughter Jordan to watch him kind of come up through the ranks just keep trucking along and get a little attention this year. It's been exciting for everybody involved, especially for Jake. And yeah, you know what? I'm a proud papa, and love to watch him play. I always have loved being in buildings and watching him play, and just being a dad. And as I told you earlier, I was the one with the video camera. I'd be sitting up in the corner and I'd be videotaping games. And you know, my daughter the same thing in soccer. They just hated it, but I you know what? It was my way of just kind of focusing in on them and watching them, and I loved it.
It's got to be kind of neat for you as well, for your entire family, considering he's coached by one of your former teammates, Mark Lamb.
Yeah, you know, it's Mark Lamb's the coach and general manager in Swift Current. And, you know, I went to the first three training camps there. It was funny because Chopper, as I call Mark Lamb, was my teammate in Edmonton. He kind of took me under his wing when I went to Edmonton. So he was the guy when I first got to Edmonton that you know, he's a veteran guy. He grabbed me and kind of showed me the ropes, showed me where things were in Edmonton, and we developed a real good friendship. And then to have it come full circle and my kid get thrown into his organization and him to take him under his wings, it's been pretty great to watch, you know. And Chopper's that old school guy. He's really a fundamentals guy. He wants the players to play the right way, a certain way, and he's not afraid to punish you if you don't. And I think that it's been beneficial. I've watched the games over the last year and a half, and how the little details in the game are so important nowadays, and that's what he preaches, and why some really good players are coming out of Swift Current. And but from a personal note, just exciting to see my kid with one of my friends.
Have you thought about what you're going to feel like when you hear your son's name called in Sunrise in June?
Yeah, I have thought about it. You know, we're really excited, and we're proud of him. We're excited for him. And, you know, again, it's so much different now, Jeff, as we've talked about. And, you know, just with all the hype and the scouts and the way they scout, it's not just necessarily watching the games now. They want to interact with the players. They want to talk to them. They want them to do evaluations and tests. And it's there's been a lot already, and it's been interesting for me from – in a different perspective to see how this is all done. And, you know, Jake's taken it in stride. He's been great with it. And he's, you know, he likes it. He enjoys it, which is important, because that's really what we've always talked about, is just have fun with this and be excited about this, because you can get overwhelming at times. But, you know, we're really excited for the draft and to see what happens with it. It's a long ways away still. So it's, you know, definitely in the back of our minds, but there's still a lot of season to go here. But, yeah, there's no question we've thought about what it's going to be like.
It should be outstanding. It's a great hockey story. And for your family, it's an even greater family story of watching your son get drafted into the NHL. Louis, thanks so much for stopping by today. We'll, I guess I'll say this. We'll see you at work.
Yeah, sounds good.
Thanks, Louis.
All right.
I'm Jonathan Durant from the Tampa Bay Lightning. I play for the Halifax Mooseheads in the Major Junior League.
Well, Sam, our next guest was a former member of the QMJHL. He played with Sherbrooke, the Castor. Also was part of the 2001 Top Prospects game, playing on Team Cherry that year, who lost to Team Moore 5-3. Nicholas Corbet joins us now. Nicholas, how are you, my friend?
Really good, really good. Thank you, guys. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is all ours. When we look back, we'll talk about the prospects game and then talk about your career with Sherbrooke. But when you look back at your prospects game, I talked to Colby Armstrong yesterday about his game, and he was in the same game. And he said, there's a lot of guys that I had never met before and never saw afterwards, but there are other guys that I had friendships for pretty much my entire life. What was your story about going into and coming out of the prospects game in 2001?
But obviously, it's something special, you know. When you're young and you look at those games, you always wonder, maybe one day I'll be able to go there. And I was able to go, and it was something special that I will remember for the rest of my life. And you get to play against guys that you hear about them because they're good in the other leagues, but you get to play against them and show what you can do against the best player. With the three leagues combined, so it was pretty special. And I had some good friends there too. Jason Pominville was in that game, and he's a good friend of mine. We're from Quebec, obviously. So, and Sean Collymore was in that game too. And I'm still talking to those guys today. And I got to match like guys like all-star, like Jason Spezza, Derek Roy. So it's fun to be a part of those games, and it's something, like I said, that I will remember forever.
How did you, the game has evolved some since then. When you showed up to play in that game, what was the mood? What was the feeling? Were guys taking it as an all-star game? Were they taking it as a very serious game? I mean, I'm interested to see what the mood was back in 2001.
Back then, like, it was really serious. Nobody was taking that as an all-star game. Like, we had, like, you know, you have the testing on the ice the day before that game, and it's only the scouts of every team are allowed in the ring. So, obviously, the guys want to show, like, what they can do. And after that, the next day, it's a big game. And I remember, like, this speech Don Cherry was telling us, like, it's a showcase. It's prove yourself that you can be like an NHL player one day, and like you got like one, well, you got more than one opportunity, but obviously you play in your league and you like they're watching you there, but it's a big window to prove yourself against, like I said before, like the best player in all the three leagues. And I remember, like it was a big game. Like I remember, like I think Kobe Armstrong hit like Soucy, a French guy, first shift. Like he hit him hard, and it was like the guy what? Got he was hurt on that play, but it just showed you like how intense that game was. Like everybody was finishing their check, and everybody was going hard.
I remember because I talked to Colby about the game, and the first thing he said was, he said, I can't remember who the player was, but Chris Thorburn just exploded on someone in that game in a crushing body check. But yeah, I mean, Colby said that it was the interesting thing that he said to me was it was the first big deal game that he ever played in. Like at that point in his life, that was the biggest hockey game he'd ever been a part of. Did you have a similar sense of that game?
Oh yeah, for sure. It was by far the biggest game, and with everything that goes around it, you know, like Don Cherry, Bobby Orr, and like it's special. Like it's a fun game. It's a fun game to be a part of it, and it's everything is huge. Like you know, like before the game, after the game, we had like supper, like some nice restaurant. Like you get to meet like other older NHL player. Like I remember Lanny McDonald was there and guys like that. So it's it was fun. It was really fun. And the people that can have the player that can have a chance to play in that game, like it's something really special.
Part of what we do is the alumni thing, and we like to see what guys are up to now. I mean, your career's kind of moved all over the place to the East Coast League and the UHL, LNAH, which is always interesting. But what is it that you're up to these days?
Well, now, like you know, like I'm a sales rep for the Labatt Brewery, so like that's my main job now. And I've been doing this
for the last
4 years, and you know, like I know, like people have their thoughts on the Quebec League, but it's just not like it used to be anymore. Like, yeah, there's some fighters, like they have like your 3-4 tilt a game, but it's a pretty good caliber, and it's a good sideline. You know, I can still enjoy playing hockey and at a good level. And like now, like you'll see like more players coming from like junior that's gonna try a league because they're getting paid, they're getting their education paid, plus they're getting paid to play, so why not, you know? And there's some guys that have been playing in Europe for like a certain amount of years, and they want to come back, but they don't really know what they're going to do after hockey. So they come here, they're still playing hockey, they go back to school, they're getting paid to play hockey, plus they're getting, again, their school paid. So it's a good transfer after your real career, you know?
You know, that league exists in it's such a an interesting place in hockey fans' minds because we think about it as, you know, as you mentioned, Nicholas, that league where it's just nonstop fights and line brawls and, you know, yard sales. And I think maybe a lot of that is fueled because one of the only things we've seen about that is that documentary that was made a few years ago, The Chiefs, or Les Chiefs.
Yeah, no, exactly.
Come on, Dion Francais.
Like I said, it used to be like that. Back then, yeah. It was a gong show, like, no doubt about it. But now, the only sad thing about it is, well, you know, like, there's some bad stuff that happens in every league, like NHL, like AHL, East Coast. But in our league, every time there's something bad about it, there's something bad happening, well, that's all the media are talking about, like, you know. But all the good stuff, like, nobody cares about it. Nobody talks about it. It's just like, oh, no, there's a brawl in the LNAH, so let's talk about it. But it happens, like, once every 3 years now. And back then, it used to happen every game.
It was a different time.
So, Nick, I just want to, your experience, you know, a lot of companies look for people who've played competitive sports to recruit them to go and work for them. How do you think your experiences help you now in your current role as a Labatt guy?
Well, like obviously, it helped me a lot. Like
you know, like all, like all the, it's a man thing in the Laval. Like we're all like man, like the reps, like there's girls, but not man, not too many. And then on my team, like we're 13 reps and it's all boys. And it's almost like a team, you know, like, you know, like you want to do your numbers at the end of every month, but sometimes like you're falling a bit behind, but you have your buddy right beside you that he's got a good month and he's going to help you through your month. And it's fun because like all the experience that I gained playing hockey and being around a team and being around my teammates helped me a lot throughout my career with Labatt. So it's a good follow-up, I guess.
You know, let me ask you about this.
Sorry, Jeff.
Go ahead.
Saint-Con, where is that to sell on your list of beers?
That's my favorite. I love Saint-Con, yeah.
That's my favorite. Where is that on your list?
I didn't hear what you just said, sorry.
The Labatt 50, one of my favorite beers. Where's that on your list?
Labatt Saint-Con.
We're trying to get it back a little bit because it used to, it was bad like the last couple of years, but now we're bringing it back. And we had a good year actually with Labatt 50. Like we're way better year than the last couple of years.
Used to have the best commercial. Remember those commercials that said, me and the boys in our 50? Me and the boys in our beer? I love Labatt 50, man. Those are the best.
But it's a good beer. It is a good beer. But like
I know.
More like going with Budweiser and Bud Light, you know?
Yeah, no thanks. I'll take Labatt 50. Thank you very much, Nick. I'm still one of those guys. Hey, my sister went to Bishop's University for 4 years, and so I spent a lot of time in Sherbrooke when I would go to visit her. Obviously, what was your experience like in that town? What was Sherbrooke like to you?
Oh, it was fun. I spent 4 years there, and it's young. Like with all the university like around Sherbrooke, like you know, it's a young town. You know, like downtown and everything. It was fun, a good restaurant, the rink, the crowd was good back then, and I had good time. Plus, I was there, I started there when I was 16, and was fortunate to be drafted with Jonathan Robert, one of my best friends. We played hockey, like all our minor hockey together, and we got drafted by the same team, and we were living at the same billet, so it made it so much easier for me, like, for my stay in Sherbrooke. And I was fortunate to play for Joe Canale.
Joe Canale.
I was fortunate to play for Joe, and I think he helped me so much to be a better man and a better player. And I will always remember what he said, like the year I got drafted, before the year he told me, like, you could be a good junior player, but you could be a guy that will get drafted and will move on, and that's what I want you to be. And he's like, if you're willing to listen to me, and that's what I did, and I was fortunate to be drafted, and I can't thank him enough for that. And he was by far the best coach I ever had.
Because you went around a lot of places. Where was your favorite place to play, Nick?
Well, I would say the Rockford Ice Hog, because we won the cup that year, so it was a fun year, and it was a good time. We won it all, and it was a good year for me.
Hey Nick, my last question for you would be: Have you gone back to Sherbrooke? Have you seen what they've done to the rink there? And
I wanted to go back, but sometimes, you know, like with the family and everything, now it's tough. But I saw it on the TV and all that stuff, and I'm happy for that town. I'm so glad they got their team back, and it's a good town for sports, for hockey, and now I think they got a pretty good person in place with Justin Thibault and all his group. And we can see like it's going well for them, and now I don't think they're gonna lose that team anymore. It's good for a long time, and so glad for that city. They deserve it.
Absolutely. On that, we'll let you go. Listen, thanks so much for stopping by and sharing some of your memories. And best of luck avec Labatt et puis Labatt Saint-Cont. Bon chance, mon ami. Bon chance.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me, guys.
Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you.
Bye.
who Sam has played in a lot of leagues, a lot of leagues. When you go to his hockey, I love guys that have hockey DBs that read like this from Sherbrooke. We got Norfolk, back to Cape Breton and Hershey and Mississippi and San Diego and Augusta and Lowell, and you mentioned Rockford, Milwaukee, into the LNAH with Saint Jean, Thetford Mines. I mean it. Whether when you go through experiences like that in your life, generally those things can make you. It's funny because you look and say, "Oh, well, what can you have learned along the way?" You learn how to face adversity, and you learn how to challenge yourself, and you learn how to adapt to different situations.
When you have to scroll down to get to your final career numbers, that's when you know you've been a lot of places. And Nick's been a lot of places. No, good of him to join us. It's it's fascinating because so many times all we do is think about players and playing in the National Hockey League, and that's it. But how many times have you seen a guy develop and then he goes and plays CIS hockey, and then he has to go out in the real world and go to work, and those experiences that they've had playing in the Canadian Hockey League, you know, make you a better team member when it comes to being on a team, when you're selling or marketing or in advertising or whatever the case may be. And I'll give you a good example of a guy that I can think of most recently is Colby Pridham, who played with the Halifax Mooseheads and then went on to play both at UNB and St. Mary's, which is an oddity in and of itself. But now he's a guy who's working in sales at MLSE and working his way, up through that company. So a lot of that has to do when you look at the guy's resume and his background. While he's been part of a team, he knows what it's like. He's not going to be rattled by working longer hours, or he knows how to work with other people. So those experiences are important, and I think Nick, he shed some light on that.
And you want people that won't wilt when they're put in positions where they're not comfortable, and they want new challenges because they know that'll help them grow. And good for Nick, and a nice little career. And we wish him best of luck with Labatt, with one of our favorite beers, Labatt Saint Colt. Oui, c'est vrai ça. Okay, Sam. So straight ahead for us on sports, so we have Kamloops and Victoria on Friday. Sunday affair is Prince Albert and Saskatoon. But before that, on Thursday, we've been looking forward to this game all season long. The BMO CHL NHL Top Prospects game. The McDavid Show is always a fun one to watch. What are you most looking forward to on Thursday, Sam Cosentino?
Well, I'm looking forward to just seeing the game being played at the highest level with the best guys that are in this age group that are in the Canadian Hockey League. So I guess what I'm looking forward to is seeing a real intense game, seeing a game that was entertaining like I thought it was last year, and seeing guys get to work early. That's the one thing. Whenever I come to this game, it seems like it goes so fast. So I'd like to see it get to its top pace right away. That isn't always the case, because usually guys are feeling things out and wondering what the coaches are thinking. And, oh, my gosh, there's a lot of people on a lot of scouts here. The quicker it gets to the top pace, the better for me. And I think we got a couple of guys who can elevate it quickly. McDavid obviously leading the way in that regard.
Now, this will be, we'll end on this one, Sam. This will be my first time at the Meridian Center. Haven't been there yet. Oh. Brand new bar. What am I in store for now?
What's really cool about this barn is how it's going to revitalize the downtown area. So essentially you have two bridges that come from the downtown core that you walk into the top of the building. It's almost like Chavez Ravine if you've ever been there for a Dodgers game. And then you take elevators down into your seats. So it's built kind of in a hole nested between the 406 and like Westchester Road. It's almost like where the thing dips down. So for the most part, people are coming from the downtown core, which is literally at the top of the arena. So that's really cool. You're going to love it. It's a beautiful barn, great broadcast location, nice big wide concourses. Excellent building, wonderful addition to the OHL. You're going to love it, Jeff.
So this is sort of being used, the new Meridian Center, to revitalize, much like the rink in London was, the then John Labatt Center, now Budweiser Gardens, because that has worked
huge
fantastically.
There.
That's got to be the model. If you're Niagara, that's the model you're looking at, right?
Yeah, it's cool because really there's the way they've designed it is that there are two pedestrian bridges that are wide, but you come in, I think it's St. Paul Street, which is the downtown street there, and you can only take one of these two bridges to get into the building. So you're forced to kind of go back out once the game's over into that downtown area. And there's already a couple of cool spots, good burger joint there. You're going to love it. It's a great spot.
Okay, you know what your job is now, Sam? I'm going to be there tomorrow, but by the time I arrive, I need you to find me a place where I can have a 50 on tap.
Okay, I'll work it.
That's your job tonight after you put all your assignments.
I'll get back on the horn with Nick and see where where it's at.
Exactly. Where are they pouring? Where are they pouring? Okay, on behalf of Sam Cosentino and our producer, Matt Brown, thanks so much for joining us on a marathon edition of Junior today. Thanks for sticking with us right to the very end. We will talk to you again next week on your favorite CHL podcast right here at sportsnet.ca, or if you downloaded us on iTunes. Have a great week. Enjoy the prospects game on Thursday.